Welcome, one and all, to the podcast dedicated to exploring the vast media landscape in search of its finest creatives. I'm Darren, your host. Welcome to Heroes of the Mediascape. My featured guest today is an independent author and a collegiate reference and instruction librarian. Please welcome to the podcast, Peter Bremer. How's it going, Peter?
Thanks, Darren. Nobody's ever called me a collegiate librarian. I seem so important and professional. Oh my gosh. But it is really good to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yes, me as well. For those who don't know, Peter and I go way back a decade ago, actually, in fact. But we'll get there in a second. But first, I have a very, very, very important question for you.
Okay, I'm ready.
What makes Terry Gilliam your favorite film director?
Do I like Terry Gilliam? I do. I do like Terry Gilliam. I would say because he's a visionary filmmaker. So it's like, he's like one of those directors, right? Like Coppola or Spielberg or whatever, fill in the blank, where you want to go to their movie because it's a Gilliam movie or a Coppola movie, right? So you're getting something special. You're just not getting a cookie cutter kind of a movie, right? And nobody else does a movie like Terry Gilliam, right? I mean, for some people, that's not a great thing. And for other people like me, it's usually a wonderful thing. He dabbles in the fantastical. He takes a lot of chances. He can be very absurd with what he does. He can poke fun at a lot of different people and ideas. I think even though he can be a little silly, there's a real serious kind of underpinning to what he does. So, yeah, I don't know. I've always liked Gilliam, even back, like when he was on Monty Python's Flying Circus and he did all those crazy animations. I fell in love with his movies, starting with Time Bandits and all the way through, I guess his last one was The Man Who Killed Don Quixote in 2018. And he's in his 80s and he's still trying to make movies. So, you go, right? That's pretty impressive.
That's amazing. Yeah, like Clint Eastwood.
Exactly. Just doesn't want to stop, And Terry probably would have made a lot more movies had he been more able to bow to studio pressure. But he's like, I'm making my movie and that's it, right? That's kind of how Terry operates. And so sometimes studios kind of give him the cold shoulder sometimes. But he's made a lot of really great movies, right? It's like Brazil, definitely comes to mind. Fisher King, 12 Monkeys. My favorite, though, out of all of his movies is a lesser-known film called The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is just a really over-the-top kind of fantasy movie. And it's based on like a 18th century series of stories, so it's very different.
I bet, yeah. I haven't seen that one, but it is now on my watch list. So
there's a book out there that actually details that movie, which is called Losing the Light, because he got a major studio to back that movie, and he was filming it in Europe. And there were like delays and cost overruns and disasters that happened and all this kind of stuff. And so it ended up losing money. And it was kind of the poster child for like movies that just like go wrong, right? And, I think Gilliam he's kind of protested that, like it wasn't that bad. But for a long time, that's what people thought of when you would mention that movie. It's like, oh, nobody's ever lost so much money. But I mean, it's been like over 30 years. So it really is it's quite a work of art, I think. So it's worth checking out.
Absolutely. It sounds like it stands the test of time.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a hidden gem, right? You can talk about different directors and authors, and you're like, sure, you've read that, you've watched that, but do you know about this one, right? So, yeah, I mention it to people. Just, you know, I like to get stuff that's unnoticed, but I think is worth people's time. I like to try to navigate people to those, because everybody knows the biggies, right? So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The way it should be.
Right. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Have you heard of Citizen Kane?
Yeah. Have you seen The Avengers?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, he's definitely one of my favorite directors. So.
For sure. And just when I was looking over your website, I noticed you had, you know, your section about your hobbies and your interests, right? And sure. Some of which we have talked about in the past a little bit.
Right.
Quote, I enjoy biking, tennis, pickleball, hiking, playing board games.
Yeah.
You can never have too many.
Right.
Reading and pretending I can make music, end quote.
Exactly. Right. I'm pretty honest and straightforward. So I like to hike. I like to bike. I like to play games, board games especially. But I have a friend, and we, for the last like maybe 10, 15 years, we'll get together. Oftentimes it's remote now, and we'll just, we'll kind of pretend we're making music. It's my friend actually, he plays all the instruments. Okay. I can't play. That's why I say pretend. I can't play guitar. I wish I could. I can't play piano or saxophone. I love music. Absolutely love music. But I am a writer, right? And so I write lyrics. I come up with melodies. And I can kind of help structure songs. But it's my friend doesn't need to pretend, but I need to suspend my disbelief a little bit. So our band is called... band in quotes is called Wishes for Fishes. And you can find us on Spotify and other places if you dare. But it's really just kind of like, I don't know, just kind of pop rock, that sort of thing. So yeah, but it's fun. You know, I like being creative. So, I'll dabble in all kinds of areas.
Nice. Yeah. Wishes for Fishes. It kind of brings me back to like Tears for Fears.
Exactly, you know? It is. Yeah, only so different.
Yeah.
So very different on so many levels. But, you know, we do it. I mean, we get together and make some tunes up because it's fun, which is kind of the same reason why I do a lot of my writing, like a lot of my books. You know, that's not my job. I don't really make a lot of money off of my books. But I enjoy doing it. I love being creative. That's what really kind of gets me up in the morning is just, you know, I like helping people. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, how helping people and being a benefit to like society can be a good thing if you can do that in your job and other ways. But the other thing that gets me up is really just how can I be a little creative during the day somehow? So, yeah.
Do you have a favorite board game?
Favorite board game. Yeah, nobody, you're not going to know it. Nobody's going to know it probably, but my favorite board game is it's called Voluspa. And you can't even buy it. So it's like if anybody like listens to this, they'll be like, "Oh, Voluspa, I got to check it out." But it's like out of print, right? But it's a tile-based game. It's a tile-based game with like a Norse mythology kind of theme, and you're basically laying down tiles, scoring points, and there's like 20 different like Norse characters, and they all have different powers, and I don't know, it's just really fun. But yeah, my wife and I, we actually will we'll play board games usually every weekend, and you know, the classics from Ticket to Ride, you know, to kind of party games and that sort of thing. I just like being able to actually get together and talk with people and interact face to face. I don't really do a lot of video games or online stuff. I just like getting together with friends or new people and you know, just spending a couple hours.
Absolutely. My wife and I are very similar in that aspect as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any favorite board games or?
You know, I think my favorite is probably Clue.
Clue is a very, it's a classic game. It's a classic game. In fact, so the library where I work, if I can mention that, so I'm a librarian at the University of Minnesota Morris, and about once every month or so, we have these game nights. And so we have all kinds of board games and we bring them out and people play them. We have tons of games, but the games oftentimes that get the most use are games like Clue and Monopoly. And I think we even have an old Life game. You know, it's like the games that, you know, students probably grow up having at home, you know, playing at home. And they're like, I know that one. So I totally get that. Clue's a great game. Yeah.
Classic. Yeah.
Yep.
And, you know, you mentioned you're a writer, and maybe this is a good time to get into it. I know you mentioned on your website that some of the more influential books in your life have been like The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, Childhood End, The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell, which I'm familiar with.
Sure.
What makes those books specifically so influential to you as a reader and as a writer?
Yeah. So, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't like to read a lot. I loved being read to, like as a little kid, but it took me quite a while to actually find books that I wanted to read. And Childhood's End, I think I was in middle school, was probably one of the first books that really turned me on to reading. And Childhood's End is a science fiction novel. I think it was written like in the 1950s by Arthur C. Clarke. It's basically just about this alien race called the Overlords that comes to Earth, and they basically say, you got to stop all this fighting. You can't do it anymore. We're all going to get along. But we're going to kind of manage things, right? So it was kind of this, you know, relatively hands-off. They weren't there to, like, take over. But they were like, you can't act the way you've been acting, right? And I don't know, it just had a real impact on me. And that kind of got the ball rolling. And then, you know, a little bit later, I ran across other science fiction and fantasy books, because that was my wheelhouse. Everybody has a wheelhouse that they tend to gravitate towards, and that was just mine, right? And yeah, you mentioned The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant. It's a fantasy series by Stefan R. Donaldson. Something spoke to me about those novels. It's about this guy who he's a leper, right? And so he has this incurable disease, and he ends up stumbling in front of a police car, and, you know, he thinks, well, this is it. That's my life. But then he wakes up and he's in this different alternative kind of reality, this place called the Land, where he's all healed and he's kind of the savior. People look to him to, like, you know, to save their world. Right. And it just spoke to me, right? I don't exactly know why, but it just did, right? But then, yeah, those were the touchstones for me. And then I kind of went on and explored, you know, other parts of those genres. And I like all kinds of writing now. I mean, I don't just read fantasy and science fiction, but I almost always go back to it, and it doesn't take that long. I started a fantasy science fiction book club in my town here in Morris, and we get together every other month and talk about, you know, a book, you know, in one of those genres. So yeah, it's I don't know, some people think that fantasy and science fiction is just escapism and that it maybe can be vacuous. I think that's a pretty outdated term or an outdated kind of notion. Because if you look at some of the really, really interesting and thought-provoking books that authors are writing these days and have been writing for for decades, you know, it's, I mean, you can hold those up to any of the classic literary books, in my opinion, right? I mean, there's good fantasy and science fiction. There's great science fiction and fantasy. There's kind of not so good. There's derivative fantasy and science fiction, but there's also great mysteries. There's also mystery books that aren't so great. There's straight fiction that's like, oh, it's not that. I mean, so I think for a long time, fantasy and science fiction, they were kind of looked down upon. And I think that's changing, sort of like I know you have a love for superheroes and movies and that kind of thing, a little bit.
Just a little bit.
But for a long time, right, it's like those were kind of like, oh, that's kids, you know, and now that's in the mainstream. And I think, you know, in general, fantasy and science fiction has a lot more credibility. And I think, I mean, that's a good thing. I think that opens the doors for, you know, more creators and more people to enjoy it. You know, it's used to be when I was growing up, like I used to play D&D, you know, I used to kind of do kind of these nerdy things, right? And it's like, you know, you didn't tell everybody, you just did it in your own little group. And now it's like, you can be a big, whatever, comic nerd, D&D nerd, whatever nerd. And it's just accepted, you know, I think that's really cool. I mean, we obviously as a society have a lot of issues that we need to address and are struggling with, but I think there's definitely a lot more acceptance in terms of, hey, this is what I like, you know, and it's like, all right, good for you.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so great, is that film can be subjective, you know, and we can all kind of like certain things, obviously some more than others for certain reasons. To me, I guess what speaks to me most about like science fiction and fantasy is the ones that really stand the test of time, or the ones that really either like touch on like the human condition in a mm-hmm. sense, or in a way kind of drive parallel to what's happening in our real world. Yes, it takes place as escapism, like in its own, you know, in its own world, right? In its own universe. But in a way, it's still, we can relate to it because there's certain themes in there that tie into like what we are going through in the present, you know, or we have recently gone through in the past.
Right. Yeah. You know? I mean, Stefan R. Donaldson, I mentioned before, his kind of aim in writing is to explore what it means to be human, right? And I think the best literature, the best films, the best music, they kind of help us explore as individuals, like what does it mean to be human? Because I mean, that's what we're all doing. We're like, you know, who am I? What does it mean? Why am I here? You know, love, death, all that stuff, right? So I think that's what great works of art will do. But they can also entertain, right? You can have both, right? So they're not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely. And I know you mentioned The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell, who's famous for like the hero's journey. Right. I know George Lucas has mentioned in the past that his original trilogy of Star Wars, and I guess you could say the prequel trilogy as well, but his Star Wars movies in general were like heavily based on Joseph Campbell's philosophy in terms of the hero's journey. Right. And I know you're a big Star Wars guy, right?
I like Star Wars. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the 4, 5, and 6, probably more than some of the others. But yeah, no, Star Wars made a huge impact on me. Yeah. And Lucas was heavily influenced by Joseph Campbell and that hero's journey. Kind of the idea that there are heroes and these heroic stories that have been told through different cultures over time. But they have these shared experiences, right? Heroes go on a journey and certain things happen in kind of these different stages. And I think, yeah, he definitely took some of those ideas, and you can, you know, my wife and I have taught a course, we called it Myth from the Page to the Stage, at our university, where we used Star Wars as kind of a template for showing the hero's journey, right? Because that's been mapped out pretty well And when I was a kid, I was let's see, how old I was. I 12 years old when I saw Star Wars: A New Hope when it first came out in the movie theater. And I didn't know anything about Joseph Campbell, but there was definitely something about that movie that was elevating. Like the special effects were cool. We'd never seen anything like it. But there was something else there, right? I think that was one of those movies, one of those stories that was tapping into something bigger and deeper. It's like even as a kid, when Luke is he's trying to destroy that Death Star, and he's has his computer on, and he's trying to decide, if he should hit it or not. He hears that voice, and his mentor is saying, just let it go, right? So there was this like spiritual component to it, which I think only resonates more now with all the technology we have with AI and everything else. There's something more than just like our machines and our technology. And that's part of exploring what it means to be human. Like I don't know exactly what that is. I'm not a hugely religious person, but I'm very spiritual. And so that's always kind of fascinated me.
Yeah, for me, like when I was growing up, it was Harry Potter. Those movies are coming out, the books are coming out. It was the rage, and I would when the new book came out, I would always me and my sister and my mom, we would always take turns reading it, watching the movies endless times, still do. That was my hero's journey per se when I was growing up. I could relate to Harry, I could relate to those characters, and just the world building was just incredible. And I know J.K. Rowling kind of gets a some flack online and in general these days. Maybe justifiably so, depends who you ask. But yeah, to me, it doesn't take away from my enjoyment of the series. So.
I got to say, I was a little jealous because I was a librarian at the time those books were coming out, and I would have some of my elementary kids asking for them, and that kind of thing. And I thought, how cool is it to have these books coming out kind of mirroring your own journey, right? It's like the characters are growing up as you're growing up. It's like you're maturing as these characters are maturing. And I just thought, that's just so incredible to be able to be there while these books are coming out. It's just magical. But I know what you're saying, about some of the criticism of Rowling, and I mean, we don't need to dive into that. I think some of that, some of that is valid. And I have talked to some people, some students, where that really affects their enjoyment of it. Of the books, right? Or the movies. But that all comes down to how, can you, and everybody's different, can you divorce the person, the creator, from the art they've created, right? And that's kind of an individual thing, right? I mean, for some people, it's like you can talk about Woody Allen, right? And it's like, definitely he's made some great movies, very talented director, but with some of the controversies surrounding him, that can be a no-go. It's like I can't see those movies anymore. And for other people, they're like, well, I'm not crazy about what that person did, and I have major problems with that or whatever, but they can still enjoy the art. And I mean, that's an individual decision, I think. It's everybody has their own lines that they draw, I guess.
Yeah, I love the way you phrase that, how it's individual to the person who's watching it and experiencing it. I guess I haven't really thought of it in that way before, but yeah, that I love that phrasing because it provides a choice, it just doesn't have to be one side or the other, yeah, I love that. That's awesome. That's great.
I think, as a culture, we become, I think hopefully we're getting better in terms of our sensitivities and we're educating ourselves, right, about different cultures and about, you know, just different experiences, right? And, you know, privilege and all that sort of thing. I mean, you know, over the last 10, 20 years, there's been such a wonderful explosion of just, you know, multicultural fantasy, especially, but also science fiction in those genres. And it really opened up, I think, different worlds. So it's not just this European kind of fantasy, right? There's obviously so much more. And then readers, different readers with different backgrounds can see themselves, you know, in those stories. And I think that's really important. But I think equally so, there's stories that now may seem a little dated. Like I grew up, you know, like kind of the 70s and 80s. And I read some of those stories and yeah, they, you know, things, you know, time moves on and things don't always age great. But there's still a lot of good literature that was created, fantasy and science fiction in those time periods. And I'm sure we'll look back 30 years from now. We might look back at this time and go, oh, you know, like, well, there'll be issues. I mean, that's just kind of how it goes, right? And I mean, but we're still reading Shakespeare. We're still, you know what I mean? So, I mean, if it's really good art, if it's art that's actually really saying something, then it's probably going to give it longevity, right? Maybe in spite of the fact that, you know, if it's a movie filmed in the 80s and somebody has big hair, but if the story's really good, maybe you can look past that, right? Or whatever it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, and certain trends come back around too. So
they do. You know. They do. Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's talk about you and your author career. So, if not mistaken, your debut novel was Treetops, yes?
It was. It was back in 2020. Yep.
Awesome. So, well, first off, like, if you want to just give like a brief overview, like, what is the story about and what inspired you to write this young adult coming of age story?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been writing since I was probably back in middle school. I started writing poetry and I wrote kind of short stories in high school or college. And I don't know. I had this idea about what would happen if when they became extinct, what if they didn't really die, but they kind of went to like a, I don't know, it's kind of like my version of an agnostic heaven or something like that. Because I've always been really interested in environmental stuff, you know, species going extinct, climate change, just the general welfare of the planet. It's always been kind of an interest of mine. I thought, well, who would be in this story, right? And I kind of, first thing I thought of was this young girl, right, who's, you know, feeling a little bit isolated. She just, her family moved across country. Her mom had, you know, died a year ago, and she wasn't in a very good place. And we've all been in that situation where we're not in a good place, or there's a time in our lives where things aren't going great. We have a lot of adversity or whatever. And so I was trying to come up with a story that would be relatable, but would also kind of, I'd be able to express some of my own interests, you know, like with, you know, the environment and what we're doing to it. And so it just slowly over time, I kind of started kind of writing, jotting down ideas. And it took quite a while to actually write that book. It was probably over 10 years, easy, because I went through several different drafts. And first books, I think, are often like that. Maybe not quite as long, but I think first books are usually kind of a are kind of a struggle for a lot of authors, because you're doing something you've never done before. You know, I'd never written anything that long before. And so, yeah, so I just kept plugging away at it. And yeah, and then I eventually made the decision that I wanted people to be able to read it. So I found a way to kind of self-publish it and get it out there. So yeah, that was a great experience. And yeah, that just kind of made me want to, you know, try to write more and publish more.
So what role did the COVID pandemic play in the timing of publishing your novel?
It was terrible. It was terrible timing. It was terrible timing because I'd been writing this novel for like a decade. And I had all this, as a self-published author, you have to do everything yourself, right? And you have to spend your own money. And so, you know, it came out, I'm trying to think, it came out, I guess it would have been like the fall of 2020. So it was like, I'm getting it ready to be published while, you know, the whole world is kind of collapsing. So I couldn't do any real publicity. I did some virtual events, but I couldn't do any author talks, couldn't do any readings. Yeah. I mean, when you look back at that time, it does seem so strange and surreal, right? So, I mean, I was really happy to get it out there. So that brought me joy. But yeah, I missed having the experience of that first book of really being able to engage with people directly. So, I'm making up for lost time now with my other books.
Hey, it's all good. Yep. That's, we will never complain about that. So the more Peter Berman books, the better.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know about that, but thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So did you have any thoughts in mind at the time of like delaying the release and just waiting till like 2021, seeing if things change? Did that ever cross your mind?
Where were you? Where were you back in 2020, summer of 2020? That would have been probably a good idea. But we didn't really know how long it was going to last, right? I mean, we'd never been through something like that. So that thought never occurred to me. And, you know, after working so hard, I think it was just kind of natural. I had momentum. I wanted to push it out there. People could still buy it. I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't do events as much as I wanted to, right? Yeah. Because I'm trying to think, like, even at the university, you know, where I work, I think we were kind of working remote for, it was like a year, something like that, I think. And then even after that, you know, it was like everybody was masking and people weren't really going anywhere. And so I think, yeah, I just think I needed to get it out there.
For sure. No, I totally get it. You have it done. You don't want to wait. You want it out in the world. You want it published. I totally get it.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'll come out with a special edition or something, and then I can take the rounds or something, make it an illustrated edition or something. I don't know. But yeah.
Is Treetops, is that going to be a one-off story, or do you have any sequel ideas in the works?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did think about that a lot, actually. My initial idea was to do a sequel, and I had some ideas, because everybody writes series and you have multiple books and stuff. But there wasn't anything that propelled me to write the sequel. And that maybe that'll happen someday. Like I did have ideas. But what I ended up doing instead, because it just felt self-contained. Like if you read the book, you kind of understand why. There's a nice kind of beginning and end. There's kind of a nice circle between generations and that sort of thing. And I could have continued it another generation, but I don't know. It seemed like it was all kind of complete. So yeah. So what I did instead is I had a bunch of short stories and a novella that I had done previous to my young adult novel Treetops, And I thought, well, I already have this stuff. And what if I just write a bunch more and then I could put out that? Because that seemed a lot, that seemed a lot less work than actually coming up with a whole new sequel, right? So maybe I was a little lazy. But I mean, to me, it was really, if I have an idea that won't let go of me, then I mean, I'll write it. I mean, that's when I know I need to write something or I need to do something creative. If the idea really doesn't kind of let me go. And so I ended up doing that. The short story collection is called The Forever Stone and Other Tales. And there's two novellas. There's probably, gosh, I don't know, maybe a dozen, 15 short stories and some poems. And so it's some stuff that I'd written previous to my first novel. And then there's a bunch of stuff that I wrote after. So it's about half and half. So it's not like I was just dredging up, you know, old stuff. None of that stuff was really old. You know, it wasn't like, oh, here's some stuff from high school that I did, right? It was stuff that I was all really proud of. In fact, I mean, I wrote a lot. I wrote a lot when I was younger. And there was stories that I really wanted to get out there that I felt proud of. And I might have cleaned them up a little bit. You know, that's only natural over time. You're like, oh, I do this a little bit differently. But yeah, I took the ones that I thought I really wanted to show the world. And I put those in that collection. So yeah, I'm really proud of that collection. And I was actually able to get out there and do some events, do some festivals, some book festivals. And that was a really good experience. That's kind of the experience that I didn't get to have with Treetops. I mean, Treetops was great. It'll always be my first book. Like, I did send out Treetops for a couple awards, and it actually got an award from, I think it's the Imaginarium Convention, which happens, like, I think it's like down in Kentucky or something. I was happy to get some recognition for that. And I was actually, this is a funny story, I was actually up against, like, there was in my young adult fantasy category, there was like a bunch of people, and I only knew one of them. I don't remember the actor's name, but he was the actor that played the Ferengi in Deep Space Nine, I think. And he had a book that was nominated. And I thought, okay, well, there's no way I'm going to beat this known person here, right? You know, I hadn't read any of the competitor stuff, but I just figured, you know, and lo and behold, they gave me the award in my category. And I'm like, well, that's great. So yeah. But yeah, to me, it's obviously not about the money. I'm an independent writer. It's not about the awards, you know. I mean, it's, you know, any writer or creative person will tell you that. I mean, you have to create for yourself. You can't do it for some external reason. I mean, those can be great if somebody likes your stuff or whatever. But you need to be creating for you. It has to come from inside you. And that's what will keep you going. You gotta inspire yourself or be open and let the world kind of inspire you too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause some story ideas come and go, right? And the ones that really stick with you are the ones that really speak to you and that you, like you said, you want to get out there. Yeah. So, I could definitely relate to that because I take the same approach when I write. It's all about, what I feel is really important to me.
Right.
And, I don't do it for the money. I do it for the content of like the book itself, mm-hmm. Whether that be like fiction or nonfiction, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's all about, you know, like what's important to me as a writer and what I want to say, mm-hmm. you know? And
right.
Yeah. And if people really do like it and they want more, that's a great problem to have. Right.
Exactly. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. 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 I mean, being an independent writer, it is more work. Being a writer, most writers don't make a living off of it. But I'm not complaining. I mean, I have my day job, and I'm just happy that I'm in a position where I have the time to do it, and I have the resources to get my work out there, right? I mean, if there's any publishers listening to this, I am open to a traditional publisher. but I mean, I'm enjoying putting my own stuff together, you know, right now. It's, you get a lot of control. I don't know if you had that experience with your work, Darren, but it is kind of nice. It is nice because you can control almost everything. Like, I couldn't control COVID, obviously, but you have creative control almost completely over your book, right? Over your work. And so that's nice, because then at the end of the day, it's like, it's going to look almost, hopefully almost exactly the way you want it to, which can be nice.
Yeah. It's almost like you have more creative control. So right. you can kind of, like you said, kind of get it how you want it to be.
Right.
But it also means it's a lot more work, you know, cause you have to do that many more things,
right?
You know, to make that happen. And, you know, it doesn't pay for it itself, right? The publisher's not paying for it. It's all coming out of our pockets as right. the writers, you know?
Yep,
so,
yep. Yeah. 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 But again, not complaining, not complaining right. at all. And this, my most recent book, so children's picture book, Doggone Brave, had never written a children's picture book before, but you know, the idea that I had about a boy and his dog, just seemed like more of a picture book and not like a full length novel. Right. I kind of embraced that, and I did research, and I was able to find good people. I've been really lucky to find good people to be able to work with. I mean, as we all know, if the people you work with are good, right, in like just your regular job, even if the job itself, you know, isn't the best, just if you have good people, that's so wonderful. And it could be the best job in the world, but if the people around you, you're like, oh, I wish I don't want to be here. It just does. It won't matter, right? So I've been really lucky to find good people. And for my picture book, I once again found wonderful people. I used the same editor that I did for my other two books. And then for the illustrator, because I can't draw. I don't know if you can draw, Darren, but I can't draw. I'm terrible. I'm really terrible. Oh my gosh. And so I found this great Ukrainian illustrator. So she actually lives in Ukraine. Her name is Tanya Maniki. And so she was just such a wonderful match for what I wanted in that story. I just knew right away. I mean, the illustrations, you know, the samples that she sent, she just has such a way with light. And there's kind of a whimsical but also a realistic quality to it. It was so wonderful to be able to work over, it was probably over 6 months back and forth, you know, like via email or whatever, just kind of like she'd send drawings and I'd be like, oh, I like that, but can we maybe change this a little bit? But I didn't, you know, it's funny. It's like when you're working on a project where it's kind of a partnership, like, even though I hired the illustrator, like, she's an artist, right? And so I don't want to tell her, well, this is exactly what I want, you know. I wanted her to be able to bring herself into the story. It's like a collaboration, you know. It's like nobody's dictating, right? Even though I'm paying her, it's like because she deserves to get paid. Because she's an artist, and I was happy to be able to do that, you know. Instead of, you know, there's so much AI being generated right now, and the losers of that are often the artists. So I was really happy to be able to support an artist, an actual human, and especially someone, you know, living in Ukraine, right? But it was just a wonderful experience to be able to collaborate over such an extended period of time. And I hope I get the opportunity to do that again. It was, I mean, it was really, really wonderful. So yeah, challenging, but really great.
That's amazing. Yeah, I actually worked with an artist from Ukraine as well for a book that I have written but not yet published. Hopefully we'll do that in the next year or two.
Okay.
If everything goes well.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I totally agree. And I also just want to add as a comment with the Forever Stone, the short story collection, the short story about the mysterious library where it's almost impossible to check out a book just sounds so much fun as, you know, as someone who's worked in a library, a couple of different libraries.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then with Doggone Brave, I just have to add, it is such a clever book title. Did you come up with that yourself or was it recommended to you?
You know, I'm an independent author. I have to come up with all my own stuff.
Well, kudos, because it is amazing.
Yeah. I think it works well. And I was happy when I came up with that. You know, it's like titles can be, sometimes they can be really easy. Sometimes they can be difficult. And when I came upon that, when I was like, I put it together, I'm like, yeah, that has to be the title, right? Because you want something that'll grab people, you know? But to me, I keep telling folks, it's like, yeah, I wrote the story and I, you know, it's my idea, but it wouldn't be what it is without the illustrations from Tanya. I mean, it's a picture book. I've often felt that, like picture books, you should almost put the artist first. I mean, because it's a picture book. and then the writer True. Second.
Yeah.
But I mean, in truth, I mean, it's a collaboration, right? It's a melding of the two words and pictures. So, well, I'm excited. I'm excited for your book now. I know you can't probably say anything, but is it like a graphic novel?
It is it's a kid's nonfiction book.
I
don't want to give away too much.
Just was wondering because you're talking about an illustration. So I thought it must have at least some images or some kind of artistic. Yeah,
it was actually for the book cover.
Oh, just for, I gotcha. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. 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 We're going to have to share notes later and see if we have the same illustrator or maybe even in the same area of Ukraine. That would be interesting. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that was really kind of eye-opening was as I worked with my illustrator, they would sometimes tell me like, well, what's, you know, like, here's what's been happening. Like a Russian missile struck a mile and a half from my house. Right. You know, and it's a little unreal to take in that somebody is living under those circumstances, you know, month after month, year after year, while they work on, you know, my picture book, my kid book, right? You know? I can't imagine what that's like to be living under those kind of circumstances. But I felt really privileged to be able to learn a little bit more about what they were going through, and just the fact that they were able and willing to share their talent with me at the same time. So yeah.
Yeah, and in a way that you're also helping them with their career as well, you know, with their resume. So
exactly. No, exactly. Yeah. And they have written so many books, or illustrated so many books. I mean, I was fortunate to work with them, I think, than probably the other way around. It's really fun for me as a creative person to be able to have those kind of collaborations, because when you're just writing, it's pretty solitary. And so I really got spoiled being able to work with an illustrator, because for me, it's not just the cover. It's, you know, throughout the book, you know, every other page is an illustration. So that was really fun.
Yeah. So with your writing process, do you prefer to write in the morning or the evening?
I don't really have a time, you know. I think when I was in college or before life gets a little more complicated after you kind of leave your high school or college environment, I probably, you know, I had more free time. I could just kind of, you know, I'll write tonight, or, you know, I'll write in the afternoon. I've never really had I always write from, you know, 6 until 9 in the morning and go to work, or, you know, I don't have any kids, but I know, you know, for some authors, it's like, okay, well, I put the kids down to sleep, I'm going to write from, you know, 9 to 12, you know, and you, cause you have to carve out time. To me, it's not about when you write. It's about making consistent time for your creative endeavor, right? Like, one of my favorite quotes about writing is basically, if you don't apply the seat of your pants, right, to the seat of your chair and write, then you're not going to get anything done. I mean, you have to be able to motivate yourself and inspire yourself to make time to do things. And there's so many distractions, right? I mean, there's so many, like Facebook, social media, TikTok, you know, there's just so many things pulling us in different directions. And so to be able to, like, say, not now, I haven't done my writing or my drawing or whatever it is today. You just have to be able to do that, right? You have to have some kind of dedication. It doesn't have to be a rigid schedule of this time to this time, but that might work for folks too, right? I never did that, but you have to be able to make consistent time available where you're not going to let yourself off the hook and you're going to be like, my goal is to write however many pages by the end of the month. I'm going to, one way or the other, I have to do that. And you have to be able to be kind of hard-nosed about it. Because if you don't actually force yourself to do the work, you're not going to get any better, right? I mean, you know, you can sneak by a little bit. You can do some pretending, but I mean, you have to do the work, right? I mean, if you're a teacher, right, you have to put the hours in, you have to do the prep beforehand. Anything that you want to be better at, guess what? You have to do the work and you have to practice. And it's not always fun, you know? it's none of this stuff is glamorous, right? I'm sure Picasso woke up in the morning and didn't feel like painting, right? but you do. You need to find ways to inspire yourself. And you also need to be able to give yourself a break. It's like, I was supposed to write yesterday and I couldn't do it, you know? It's like I was tired, I was feeling down or whatever it is. You can give yourself a break, but at the end of the day, you got to put the work in, right? And if you're really passionate about something, that's the fire that's going to get you to get up and get out of bed or whatever and do that thing, right? And if you're not, then maybe you should find a passion somewhere else, because, you know, you got to do the work.
That's true for every walk of life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, the Olympics was just on and those people were training. And I mean, you know, if it's what you want to do, figure out what you want to do. I don't know, it can be writing. It could be teaching. It could be drawing or whatever it is. And then try to dedicate yourself to it. And then you can always do something else. But yeah, I mean, and who am I to talk, Darren, right? It took me 10 years to complete my first novel. Right. But there's also something to be said for, like, also hanging in there. Right. You know, even if it takes you what you think is longer than it should, or other people, or they've done this or whatever. You know, just if you keep plugging away and, you know, and if you don't give up and if you still really care about it, then, you know, keep punching in, right? Do what you can and hopefully good things will happen. But you got to be there for good things to happen, you know.
Absolutely. And you'll have to tell me if this is true for you as well.
Yeah.
But I know for me, speaking for myself, I know like another distraction I also have when I'm writing is what I'm going to write. Because I have like 10 to 15 different ideas for books that I would love to write. Ooh. And sometimes on some days, like, hey, I want to work on this project. Hey, no, on this day, I want to work on that project. I'm not feeling this one today. Yeah. And then you don't really get anything done because you're too spread out. You know, you're not focusing on one or two specific titles that you're working on.
Right, right. Yeah, because you don't necessarily, if you don't have like a agent or publisher breathing down your neck, then you're like, oh, yeah, this was, I'm going to see where this takes me today. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I've never had that problem. I'm a one idea at a time kind of a person. There are good parts of that, and there are not so good parts of that. But I usually only have one idea at a time, whether it's like a book idea, whether it's like if I'm working on a song. That's just kind of how my brain works. You know, it's like even now, like my newest book has been out for, I don't know, it's like 3 or 4 months or something. And like, I don't really have any solid ideas. Like I have like, I've started to think about it, but like, it's not like there's like 5 other ideas that are knocking on the door because, you know, okay, you're done with that one. Now, come on, it's our turn. And I know I'll get other ideas. Like I'm not too worried about that. But yeah, that's interesting. Isn't that funny how it works for different people? You can be overwhelmed with ideas, or you're kind of like, oh, I'm still searching for my next one. What am I going to do? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you don't mind me asking, which stage of the writing process is your favorite? Is it the part where you're outlining it and kind of coming up with the idea? Is it that very first draft, which most writers will typically say is usually mostly thrown out anyway because it's not good?
Right.
Is it the final manuscript when you're finally done? Is it the marketing aspect, like you were mentioning, with going on and promoting the book?
Right.
Which stage is your favorite?
Ooh, that's a good question. I personally, I kind of like those times. They don't happen all that often, but when you're doing your artistic, whatever your thing is, you know, for me, writing, and you kind of lose track of time, right? And you're just so in the zone and you're not being critical. You're not, you know, going back and rewriting that sentence 10 times. You know what I mean? You're just allowing yourself to write and you have this flow, right? You have this flow going. And then it's like when you come out of it, then you're back kind of in real time. And you're like, oh my gosh, it's been like 3 hours and look what I did, right? And yeah, maybe it's trash, right? But maybe it's not. Maybe there's some really good bits in there. I mean, those are my favorite times, when you're just kind of, when you turn off kind of your inner critic and you're just like, you're somewhere else. You're using another part of your brain. I mean, that's what I would probably say. My least favorite would probably be the editing. And I don't dislike the editing, but sometimes it can seem there's like so many details. And, you know, especially like if you've been working on a project for a long time, I get joy out of making things better. That's the part about editing I really like. But for me, part of that joy is figuring out the story. Like, I don't usually have a huge outline. Like, for Treetops, I knew how it was going to be, how it was going to start and how it was going to end. But I didn't know everything in the middle. Do you know what I mean? Like, I knew broad brushstrokes, but I'm not one of these people that has everything laid out completely. And so part of the joy for me in writing those bigger books is discovering for myself what's going to happen. And then once I've told the tale, then it sometimes feels like a little bit more like work, having to go back and, you know, it's like do the technical stuff. And, you know, it's still fulfilling because I know it's a much better book if I've gone through it 2, 3, 4, whatever times. But it's not the same. I don't have that same joy. Starting is always hard for me too. Like if it's a blank page and I have an idea and I'm like, well, there's like a bunch of different ways I could start this, you know, or what character do I want to, you know, to be the main POV or whatever it is. Because there are lots of different ways you can approach something. But once I get over that hurdle, then I'm kind of going and I do pretty well. But those would be kind of my favorite parts and other parts that aren't maybe quite as fun.
Sure. Can you talk about what goes into a book launch specifically? Like, what are some of the marketing strategies that you use to help promote your books when you're publishing?
Right. I've used, for example, like in my first novel, Treetops, I use some paid services to get my books out there in front of folks like you, in front of podcasters and, you know, just like other influencers, reviewers, that sort of thing. I tried to kind of leverage all those different mediums, that sort of thing. I've sent my books out, to different, like if there's awards, different kind of recognition, because that kind of helps, right? If other people say that, you know, this is a good story or whatever, then that draws people's attention. Oh, why didn't you say that? What an award. I'm interested now, right? So that can be helpful in marketing your book and getting people to take a second look at it. Other marketing, you know, techniques, I guess I've started to do TikTok a little bit more and do some other kind of social media. I'm not a huge social media person. As I get older, it becomes less and less, but I've been trying to do more, you know, for my book especially, just to kind of get the word out there a little bit, because I know that is important. I'll do radio. Like I did a radio interview earlier today with a station about 45 minutes away, because I'm going to be doing a reading kind of in their neck of the woods. So I'll do radio stuff. I'll hang posters up, just word of mouth and stuff. Like, especially in small communities, you'd be surprised just by talking to people, how kind of word spreads, that sort of thing. I also try to collaborate. So with my children's book, with the themes, you know, there's a cute dog in my book. And so I've, anytime I do a reading or a book signing, I'll approach the local Humane Society and I'll say, hey, I'm an author, local author, and, you know, I have this book, I'm doing this signing, would you want to co-sponsor? And then to kind of entice it, I'll be like, and I'll give you a proceeds, you know, a portion of the proceeds to your organization. And, you know, they almost always say yes. And I'm really happy to work with them. We have a comic book shop that you may remember in my town. And, I did a signing there a couple of weeks ago, and we had one of the local shelter dogs. Actually, somebody brought this dog in. And so, you know, there's a dog, I'm signing books, right? And people are petting the dog. And then at the end of the day, I can give a little financial support to these local organizations. So, I don't know. It's like, just kind of I try a bunch of different things. I try to be creative as much as I can. I guess another thing that I've done, and I've done even probably more with the kids book, Darren, is I did seek out a professional review. So as an independent author, I don't have an agent to actually to say, hey, here's this my client's book. You should, please review it, right? So I, have to do that on my own. And so I got I got Publishers Weekly, so they're kind of a noted professional book review organization. And so they reviewed my book, Doggone Brave. And they gave it a really nice review. And so they're unbiased, right? I could have got a terrible review, right? But they happened to like it. And so that I can use that review in my marketing and my publicity, and it's on my website, and it's something that I can tell people, right? It's like, hey, you don't have to believe me. It's like, I like my book, surprise, but here's this other professional organization, and they thought it was really good, right? So I do stuff like that. I've also advertised my books in Publishers Weekly. They have an independent kind of section of their publication called Book Life, I think it is. And so I've actually paid to get my book in there, so people, librarians and bookstore owners, can actually run across it. So yeah, I try stuff, but it's all time, and it's all it. A lot of it's money, right? But at the end of the day, I want people to know about my book, right? But I wouldn't have to, right? There are a lot of writers that never publish, and a lot of writers that do publish, but then are like, it's out there. If people, they'll tell their friends and neighbors and relatives, and that's cool too. I mean, it's all good. But yeah, I like I said, I would like to get my book in people's hands if I can. Not to really make money. That's fine. That's great. But it's all about making connections, right? It's just about making connections and hearing from people. It's like, what did you think? Or, I can't tell you how many times just in the last few months with this new book, I've had people say, oh, I'm so excited to give it to my little nephew or my niece or my kid or whatever, and I'm like, and it kind of took me aback. I'm like, oh, so you're going to be reading my book to your kid at bedtime tonight, right? I mean, that's pretty awesome. That's pretty awesome. So, yeah. And I've actually had feedback from some parents. Like, there was one parent, who's a professor at the university where I work. I'll give you a hint. It has a big M. But anyway, they came up to me like a day or two later after having bought the book or whatever. And he said, oh, my son has a question for you. I'm like, oh, what is it? He's like, oh, my son was wondering why in the book, when thunder happened, why you said ba-boom instead of kaboom. And I'm like, ooh, that's a good question. Like, only a kid would probably be able to come up with that, right? It's like, and I really had to think about it. I'm like, tell your son, it's something called alliteration. Ba-boom is just more fun to say than kaboom, right? I mean, at least I think so. And kaboom also, I go, it could be like kind of like an explosion. And I didn't want that connotation. So, but yeah, to me, it's just kind of making those connections and marketing and that sort of thing just helps me kind of get my book and hopefully me, just in contact with more folks.
For sure. Yeah. And I guess on that topic too, I know your book is published on Amazon. Yes.
Right. Right. For booksellers often don't want your book just to be available through Amazon, because Amazon is a direct competitor. So for that reason, my self-publishing platform is in another place. It's available on Amazon, but Amazon is not my publisher. Yeah.
So what avenues do you take then for right. like the physical copies of your books?
Yeah. Yeah. So a couple different ways. So my publisher, my main publisher is called Ingram Spark. So Ingram Spark, it's a platform for independent publishers. I mean, there's lots of different places you can go to publish, but that's one of them. And I chose Ingram Spark because it allowed me to, it allowed bookstores to order my book. They wouldn't order from Amazon. It also allows libraries to order my book to get it on the shelves, like in different communities, right? I also have my book available. You know, it's a picture book, but it's still available in some ebook formats or in different platforms. But it's on barnesandnoble.com. You can order, you know, you can get the print book there too. So it's available. I wanted my book to be available in as many places as it could be, because again, want to get my book into as many people's hands as I can. I do have, like, the books that I sell though at these, like at these book events and festivals, that sort of thing. I order personal copies for myself, so I can do that, right? I mean, you could go to like Ingram Spark and order them too, directly. But I go there and I'll order them in larger quantities, so I can bring a big stack of books to some of these different places. So, but yeah, it's it's a whole world. It's a whole, if you're a self-published author, there's so much to know. And if I would have known how complicated it was before I started, I probably I don't know if I would have done it. But now that I've been doing it for, you know, 6-7 years, it doesn't seem bad at all. But there's always a learning curve with anything new. So yeah.
For sure, yeah, because I know when I was publishing my book, you had reached out to me offered some great resources. So
yeah,
for like,
right.
Was it Draft to Digital and Lululemon? Was that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I still use Draft to Digital for the e-stuff. And Lulu, I use just for my own personal copies that I sell face-to-face. It's kind of complicated, okay. But I use Lulu, but just for me, I use Ingram Spark for... Not to get too much in the weeds here, because people probably don't care that much about that. But I worked it kind of out so that, you know, it's a good system for me anyway. So,
for sure,
yeah.
And you know, when it does come to, you know, the digital age that we live in with ebooks and audiobooks,
right?
Is the future for physical copies of books in jeopardy?
No, if you would have asked, like maybe. Like 10 plus years ago, right? Everybody was worried about that. I'm not worried about that anymore. I think things have equalized out, right? I don't know what the split is, right? 50-50, 60-40, I don't know. And I know a lot of brick and mortar bookstores closed up and there was that big adjustment, but I don't think it's in jeopardy, you know? I mean, not in my lifetime. I mean, I don't know, like if you go like 30, 40 years from now, will the print readers, will they maybe shrink or, you know, contract? I don't know, maybe. Although when I ask my students, my college students, when I ask them, like, how many of you prefer print books and how many of you prefer ebooks? What do you think they say?
Print.
Print. I mean, I'm at a small college, right? So maybe if this was the Twin Cities or like, you know, some big library, big city, maybe that'd be different, right? But yeah, that when I ask our students, it's like 90-95% are print, right? So I don't know. I'm cautiously optimistic. I think there's room for both, right? I think there will be people that will always want to read print. And I think there's a lot to be said for ebooks, and there's convenience, and I think those people will be happy too. I mean, I do both. I have a Kindle, and then I also read print too. I get more frustrated with reading ebooks as of late. I don't know. It just sometimes they're kind of clunky. So I've been kind of going back more to print and stuff. But I think we'll be okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's refreshing to hear. And part of, I guess, why I asked that was because, like you know, for example, I think of physical media as a whole in terms of like, well, like movies, like DVDs, Blu-rays, CDs for music, you know, the whole physical media as a whole has kind of really shrunk the last 10 plus years. Right.
Right.
And I know lately there's been like certain like news outlets like ABC News was reporting that physical media was actually starting to gain a little bit of popularity again with the younger generation, which really warmed my heart because I am a physical media fan. So I always prefer the physical copy.
All right.
You know?
All right. So do you have like albums or CDs, cassettes? Like what do you have for music, for example?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
I grew up with CDs.
Right.
So that was like my go-to. I still have quite a few of them.
Right.
My wife actually has more cassette tapes.
That's cool.
I think you know, I inherited a whole bunch from her older stuff, you know. And although to be fair, the majority of the music I listen to is probably digital.
Right.
It's more so with like I have a pretty big like movie collection. That's kind of been my thing.
Right.
So
yeah, of course. But do you have that like in DVDs or Blu-rays or that kind of thing, or is that mostly like streaming stuff?
I would say mostly on disc. I've kind of cut back from streaming. I had a lot of the main streaming platforms a few years back.
Yeah.
But with the rising costs of all of them and the movies that, you know, they come and go all the time. And like the ones that I really enjoy, I like to have.
Right.
So I can watch whenever I can.
Exactly.
So.
Yep. Yep.
Like that's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a burden having to like, you know, just pay for all these subscriptions. And then the movie or whatever the series that you're like, I'm like halfway through it. I'm going to finish. And then they're like, oh, no, it's leaving tomorrow. And once you've been burned a bunch of times, then you're like, okay, stuff I really want. Like I'm a huge, I'll date myself. I'm like a huge Northern Exposure fan, TV show. So I have like, those are in DVDs. I love Parks and Rec. I have those on DVDs. Like the movies I really, really love, obviously the Terry Gilliam ones. Those are on DVD. Just stuff that I want to be able to grab and don't have to worry about them disappearing. I'll make sure I have, you know, so not everything, but like I'm old enough to where music for me growing up was like on albums, was like on LPs. And I really regret giving away my album collection years and years ago. Because albums, my friends, they are heavy to like lug around when you're moving. So, but I could see kind of building that collection back up again someday. That would be a fun little, like a fun little hobby or whatever. But I still have, you know, I still have hundreds of CDs. Because I was around when the transition from albums to CDs happened. And so so I got into CDs big time. But I kept them all, you know. And here's the thing, right? It's not just about the permanence thing or the financial thing. To me, it's also a social thing. So more connections, right? So when I go to somebody's house, the first thing that I notice or look around for is like their bookshelves. Like, do they have bookshelves and what's on them? Because to me, that's just a really good way to kind of like get a sense of like who this person is, right? It's just a conversation starter. And I feel the same way about music and movies. And when everything's digital, those opportunities for conversation don't always come up as naturally, right? It's like, oh, we're talking about this. Hey, oh, I have it on the shelf. Let me grab it, right? And like, is that really necessary? Well, I don't know. Probably not. But there is something about holding something in your hand. And that's probably a generational thing. You know, if you're of a certain age, that probably doesn't matter. And that's okay. But I still like those physical items too. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited that they're finally gaining popularity. And it's kind of weird at the same time because they're gaining popularity, but when they are, you know, revealing the statistics that show that popularity,
right?
They're basically saying it's shrinking less.
It's shrinking less. So,
I mean,
I like that. I like that.
That's, it is what it is.
That's like a positive spin on something that still isn't great, but yeah. But you know what though? If everybody was doing it, it wouldn't be as fun. So, you know, it's like you get to be kind of cool, right? It's like, hey, I'm collecting albums or whatever it is. You know, I have old 8-tracks or whatever it is.
There you go.
And that's kind of cool, right? It's like suddenly if everybody's doing it, then it's not as fun. I mean, I think, but so that there's that too. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. Totally agree. And speaking of media, this might be a great time to transition into Rodney Abrig's library.
Rodney Abrig's library, the library that I work at the University of Minnesota Morris. Yes, named after our first dean. So, you know the library well. You could talk about it almost as well as I could, probably. So, but okay. So I'm the guest. So yeah. So that's where I work. At the University of Minnesota Morris in Briggs Library. The building itself has been around since like 1960. So when you walk in, it's going to be a little bit like a time machine, right? So it's not all glistening computer, right? It's going to have a comfortable, cozy feel. And then we have all the technology, everything that you'll want. But it's within this kind of cozy, environment. So we got comfortable chairs and we do game nights, bring out the old board games and that sort of stuff. We do improv, we do laser tag, all kinds of fun stuff, you know. It's not just about books, although we do have books, right? So we have lots of print books and all that kind of thing. I've been working at Rodney Briggs for 22 years, and what's kind of kept me kind of going and still enjoying it a lot is the fact that I get to wear a lot of different hats and get to try new things, get to meet new people, because as you know, students come and go. They don't just usually stay there forever, right? And so, it's been a really good ride. And it's kind of my second career because we were kind of talking before we went on air that, my first gig was doing teaching. And I worked, basically preschool through high school and I enjoyed it. But I think, my real calling was doing library stuff. So that just goes to show you folks, right? If at first you don't succeed, right, you're not stuck doing one thing. You could always do something else. So, but yeah, I've been really lucky to have been at the university and at the library for so long. It's been really cool.
Yeah, and from my experience at Morris when I went to school there, I attended there from 2014 to 2017 when I graduated.
Right.
And
has that been 10 years?
Yeah.
Almost 10 years. Oh my gosh. Okay.
I know. Yeah. It's weird to think about. It's so weird to think about.
Yeah.
But I
look the same, right? Do I look the same?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You haven't aged a day.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah. But one of my favorite, I guess, memories, but just when I look back at my time at Morris,
right,
I always look back so fondly on, the time where when I worked at
right
Briggs Library,
mm-hmm.
Working with you, working with Renee,
right,
Leanne,
right,
the whole crew, and a really good friend of mine, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember Andy, who also worked at the desk there, at the time. I mean, he was in my wedding,
So these were connections you made through the library and through school, right? And they probably carry forward to this day, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I will say though, it was always a blast. Like when you were at the desk across from us.
Right.
And like when I'd be there working and we could just chat about whatever.
We could just talk. Yes. And we still do that. I still do that, people come up to the desk, we'll just kind of chat and about whatever's going on, you know, or philosophizing or, you know, we do work too. We want to make that clear. We do work too. But yeah, libraries, right? You're surrounded by knowledge. If you're in a library, you're probably a little curious. So, you know, that kind of comes with the territory. So, yeah. And, you know, it's not just, you know, Briggs Library, obviously a special place for me and for you because, you know, it's like, you know, we've experienced it. We've been there. But I think libraries are just really cool places wherever they are, right? Public library, academic library, school library. They are so cool. I mean, think about it, right? Like the library is one of the only places you can go into and you can get free stuff and get free advice, right? Like try just walking into a regular store and just taking something off and going, all right, is it okay if I take this pair of jeans? Do I need a card? Like, do you have like a checkout system? Right? I mean, or it's like you can walk in and say, I need to do this. I don't understand. Can you help me find an answer? Like if you just walked up to a stranger on the street, right? They would think you're a little crazy, right? But the public library, academic library, that's kind of what they're there for. And they're for the community, right? It's not based on how much money you have or your social standing or whatever. It's just like, are you a human being in this community? Well, great. So we can help you. Which is really phenomenal. So, I'm glad you have good memories. So that's really awesome to hear.
Absolutely. So when it comes to your position specifically, what exactly do you do as a reference and instruction librarian? Like what goes into your role?
Yeah. So I'm at a small, pretty small liberal arts university, right? Right now we have like four library professionals and then a whole bunch of really important library work study students, right? And so we tend to wear a lot of different hats. So like my two main hats, one hat is basically I'm at the reference desk and I'm there to help people with research. So finding articles, finding books. If a student, let's just say hypothetically, comes up and says, I have a research paper due tomorrow and I haven't found any resources. I'm not saying that ever has happened. You know, I could help them out, get them some articles, show them how to search databases. I can find books. I troubleshoot technology, right? People having trouble printing, using the scanner, right? I've even proctored tests. You know, we're just kind of one of the first lines of defense in terms of, hey, are you wondering how to use the library? I can help, right? So that's like one of my main hats. My other main hat that I wear is kind of instruction. So what does that mean? Classes come in. Usually it's just maybe like one session or two sessions. And I'll teach them how to actually use the library and find resources, right? So, you know, I always tell our students, I'm like, how many of you, if you're starting a research paper, how many of you are going to start with the library, right? And I'm like, just be honest. There's no judgments here. And most of them, you know, will say, I start with Google. Sorry. I'm like, that's fair. But my job, like in those sessions, is to kind of tell them, hey, I'm not saying don't use Google at all because you will, right? But I'm like, you're all paying for these resources. So like if you're a college student, wherever you're at, or if you were a college student, you were probably paying money to get access to these really good resources, right? Streaming videos, articles, books, like all this stuff, like free. Like think of it like if you got access to all the streaming video stuff for free, right? I mean, this is really cool stuff. Right? Like if you're in college and you want to learn about stuff, I mean, this is all free resources. So I try to kind of turn them on to that and show them how to evaluate sources. And so like in the age of AI, especially now, right? It's even harder. Like how can you tell if a source is good, right? Everybody's just looking at what AI tells them. And so we try to have real conversations about that. and how to actually look at, like, where is this information coming from, right? Because unless you look at the sources, you're just going to go, oh, well, you know, the AI overlords are saying this. I guess that's what it is, right? So we talked a lot about how to use library resources so they can be successful students, right? Because if you're going to school, you probably want to graduate and do something. But then to be a good citizen and to just be a functioning human being and make good choices, you kind of need to know how to evaluate stuff. And that might start with, like, looking at your apartment lease and, like, looking at, can I get my deposit back, right? And it might end up later, you know, with, you know, should I marry this person, right? It's like we're evaluating, hopefully we're evaluating our world as we make choices, because we want to make good ones. And as we get older, those choices become more meaningful. Where should I move to? Where should I go to graduate school, right? You know, who do I vote for, right? And that's all critical thinking. And so we talk about that.
Nice. How would you say the academia librarian landscape has changed over the years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not in a good way, especially in the last 4 years, right? I mean, just looking at the library landscape in general, right? I mean, libraries are under assault, you know, basically because I think they're seen in some quarters as a political liability, oftentimes by certain groups, and public libraries, the good ones, want to make sure that their community members actually have the books and the information they need, right? Libraries should reflect their community. And some of those books and resources can be controversial for some people, right? So your LGBTQ community should be reflected in those libraries. Immigrants should be reflected in those libraries. All facets of the community should be reflected. So if you like to hunt, you should find something in the library about that, right? But the whole community should be reflected in there. And right now there's an assault on public libraries to kind of take out the things that some people find offensive, right, or don't agree with. And I think that's a real problem for a civil society, right? Because, you know, we should be able to live with each other and support each other's needs without having to ban books and without having to, you know, force librarians out of their jobs or cut funding. And that stuff is all happening. It's happening everywhere, you know. It's happened in my area here, right? Like in public libraries. Academic libraries are a little more insulated, but public libraries and school libraries are often the front line, and they always have been, right? When you hear about book bannings, it's almost always in a public library or school library, right? And it usually involves kids. That's the tension point, right? People, well, my kid's not ready for that, right? Or, you know, that has this content and I don't think any kid should have that, right? So that's always been the tension point, but it's just been ratcheted up quite a bit in this very divisive kind of political world we're living in. And libraries are kind of right in the middle of that, right? And they're doing the best they can with very limited resources. And like we mentioned earlier, libraries are there for the community, right? But they're the ones that are kind of under assault, right? Because they're still trying to serve everybody and people that oftentimes don't have the resources they need or don't see themselves reflected, like on the bookshelf or, you know, in the movie selection or whatever, or the programming. So I'm definitely concerned. I'm definitely concerned about what's happening.
So then on that note, what would be your advice to the next generation interested in becoming a librarian?
Well, I mean, I guess if you are interested in maybe becoming a librarian and doing that kind of public service, I would start by talking to a librarian, talk to somebody who's working in a library and find out more about it, right? Do some job shadowing, right? Just do a little bit of research and kind of find out if that's something that's really a good fit for you, right? And if it is, then you can take the next steps, right? Like if you want to be a media specialist in a school, I mean, you don't need, generally speaking, a graduate degree. You can get like a certificate, like a media, media certificate to do that. If you want to work in a bigger public library or really any academic library, then you need a graduate degree, an MLIS degree. But I would just start by talking to people and, watching librarians and finding out more about them and then, making an informed decision. I mean, that's what I did. I thought at one point after undergraduate, after a few years, I'm like, what do I want to do next? I don't know if I want to keep doing this. And I thought, maybe librarians, maybe a library job. I like books and I like helping people. It seems like that might be a good match. And then I talk to people, right? Because especially graduate school, it's like it can be expensive. And so I didn't want to just dive into it without really knowing. So, but yeah, I mean, libraries are great places. And if you think you might enjoy that, start checking it out. Talk to people, talk to your local librarian, wherever you are and stuff. And, I mean, librarians have always been a big part of my life. Like when I was in college, there was a librarian that I can't tell you how many times they saved my life, finding me stuff. They actually ran the Doctor Who Club on my undergraduate campus. They were so awesome. They were so awesome. So, yeah. If you have an inkling that you might want to do something like that, yeah, just kind of do some research.
Yeah, and speaking of the library being under assault in recent years, I mean, I can kind of relate to that because one of my favorite jobs I've ever had has been as a library para at an elementary school. I worked in the downtown area of Grand Forks, North Dakota, called Phoenix Elementary, and I worked with a bunch of wonderful people there. It was a wonderful 3 years of my life working there. I miss it, and I miss the people.
Right.
But that was such a fun job that I had. I got to work with kids. I got to work with books. I got to handle media in general.
Right.
So it was amazing. It was great. And now in recent years, some of those positions are getting cut down to like, yeah, you can do that part time, and then the other school days, other half of the day, you have to help with this aspect of the school, like in the classroom or what have you.
Yeah.
Some of those roles are starting to go away. Even back when I worked at that school in the library, our school librarian only worked 3 days a week.
Oh, okay.
That just the way that just the budget worked out, and it's obviously been shrinking and shrinking ever since. So yeah, I can definitely relate to that and that aspect of like libraries. Yeah, I can see how it's a struggle, and sometimes like especially in a school district, that might not be what some consider to be like the most important aspect, right? So like sometimes that might be one of the first things to have cuts made to it,
I was a media specialist, a school librarian in Morris where I live. This was a long time ago, and they hadn't had a school librarian for years, and then they hired me. They found money, and then they went through union negotiations for staff, teachers. And, teachers got a raise, which they deserve, right? But part of the repercussions of that was then my position was cut again. So, I mean, the school librarians, you know, that position usually is one of the first cut, right? Even though there's a state mandate in Minnesota to have, like, you need a school librarian for X amount of students or whatever. It's usually not sustained if there's any kind of budgetary restraint. So I totally know where you're coming from there, right? And even when I was a media specialist, you know, in my town here, in the morning I would be at the high school, and then in the afternoon I would have to dash over to the elementary, right? So it's like, yeah, sometimes those librarians are like, maybe they're going to 2, 3, 4 different schools, right, every week. So yeah, and then those are the good scenarios, because the other scenario is that there is no school librarian. So
and after I worked in that library, I went on to work in Title I for a couple of years.
Okay.
And then that position was eliminated due to budget cuts.
Oh, geez.
So,
okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's just, so I can relate to that as well.
It feels like there's no safe space, right? Yeah. But I think that's part of it. It's the less emphasis we put as a society on public good, the less valuable these jobs are, right? The more we emphasize private industry and profit over community good, the more those kinds of positions will be devalued, right? So, and that's not even taking into account some of the political motivations behind, you know, some of the library tensions that have been going on, right? But it's still good work. I mean, there's so much good work to be done out there in libraries and other places. I mean, there's ways of making a difference.
Absolutely. And speaking of making a difference in libraries, I have to ask this question. It's totally unfair, but I have to ask this.
Okay.
On a positive note. Who is the best library circulation desk assistant you've ever worked with?
Man.
And it doesn't have to be me.
It doesn't have to be you. Gosh. I'm gonna have to say that it's probably a collective. If I could put all the library assistants together, right? Over all the years, right? It's like it's this continuum of library assistants. And you're in that mix, Darren. You are in that mix. In fact, in terms of conversationalist, you were at the top. You are definitely at the top of that. And you had you had expertise. I felt like I could just walk away from the desk and you would just be fine. You know? You knew what you were doing, right? So who do you think, I'm gonna turn it right back at you then. Who do you think was the best librarian at Brace Library?
Best librarian.
Who do you think that could be? You know, I don't know.
I feel like I'm gonna get in trouble if I don't say you.
No. I think you just have to speak truth.
No, sure. Yeah. And it is very tough because I really enjoyed working with you. I really enjoyed working with Leanne. I really enjoyed working with Renee.
What was Jane there then?
Yeah, I think Jane was there.
Yeah.
It's tough too because
I got a lot of competition. Yeah.
Some of the staff I wasn't really around very much.
Right.
But there's nobody that I didn't get along with, you know, like everyone was always great to talk to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I was kind of facetious before a little bit, but it really is like a community. You know what I mean? It's not like, I mean, the library can only function, an organization can only function with all of its parts, like, you know, working together. And that's like, that's, I mean, I, I, I think that's what a good library does, right? You have at all those different positions, you have people that care and are trying to do their best. I mean, that's all we're really trying to do, right? We're kidding around, but it's not really a contest, you know, it's just really,
right.
We have a shared mission, right? It's like, we're trying to help, you know, we're trying to help students find stuff and, you know, staff and faculty and that sort of thing. So we're all just doing it together. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would even extend that to the U of M Morris as a whole.
Right.
You know, like I got to work with some amazing colleagues there.
Right.
Like, you know, William White, Jonas Newhouse, they were really fun to talk to.
Yeah.
Incredibly smart.
Right.
Have
you been following? I know that they were involved a little bit. They had a record contract at one point.
I did not hear that. I must have missed that.
Yes. You should. Yeah. Look them up. After we're done, I'll try to forward the band name. But I know they were doing creative stuff out in LA and that sort of thing. So, but it's really cool. And I'm sure people, because you've been very successful too. And so I'm sure that there are people that you went to school with that are like, wow, look at what Darren's doing. That is like so cool. You know, it's fun to cheer people on and go, yeah, she's doing really cool stuff too. Right. Yeah. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And like I worked with Tessa at the front desk. That was a lot of fun. She was great to work with.
Yes, yes.
And even just like even the professors too. Like I had some really great professors. Like Dr. Janet Shrunk Erickson and Michael Lackey.
Michael Lackey.
Dr. Michael Lackey,
in
I should
English
say.
English as well. Yeah. Yep.
So.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's a wonderful thing about making all those connections. And some of those you're going to keep for your whole life and stuff, you know? I feel lucky for all those reasons, working with students like you, working with really talented colleagues. It's good. It's really good. So, and I really appreciate you making time for me to come on. I feel like I've talked a lot about me. I suppose that's the whole point of it. But I've had a really great time catching up and talking about libraries and being creative and that sort of thing. So.
Yes, absolutely. And if I can, I just have one last question before we go.
Of course.
I ask this question to every guest I have on the show. If there is any message that you want to convey to our viewers and listeners today, no matter which walk of life they might come, or which walk of life they might be in, what would you say?
Three words. So I'm just going to go back to Joseph Campbell. So you can probably guess what those three words are, but they would be follow your bliss. So doesn't mean doing whatever you want to do. It means making your life meaningful for yourself and for others and the world you live in. If you're doing something that gives your life meaning, then that's just going to make everything more enjoyable. And the world around you will probably be a happier place too. Right? So follow your bliss. It's just three little words, but there's so much more there.
And you know what? I lied. I have one more question.
I deny it. You said no more.
Yeah. Where can people find you online if they're looking for your work, looking to follow you in general?
Oh, sure. So you can, if you just Google Peter Bremer, right? My result, it should be at the very top, but if it's not, it'll be one of the first websites you see. So you can Google me. You'll find my website pretty quickly. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok, but not a ton, like I said. But you can definitely find me easy on Facebook, and you can track me down on my website. And I do have like a contact, so if you want to reach out, you can do that. And I have an appearances page where it'll list where I'm going to be, you know, upcoming readings, book signings, that sort of thing. And you can also, if you Google me and like the university, you'll run across like like professional contacts and that stuff too. So always happy to talk to people. Especially about my books and writing and that sort of thing. So
very good. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of this podcast. I'm very thankful to have you on as a guest. You're always welcome back. And I'm just can't say thank you enough.
Oh, well, likewise, right back at you, Darren. It's been wonderful catching up. Seems like old times. It's like you're staring at me across from the circulation desk there. And we've just had a long, wonderful conversation. So yeah, I appreciate the time and congratulations on, you know, everything that you've done since graduating. And yeah, and I look forward to your next book. So
thank you. You as well.
Yeah. Thank you.